From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, artificial intelligence and the search for the life of super Earths is what's happening. Well, here we go again. Another problem on a plane. A disgruntled passenger aboard a U.S. Airwaves flight from North Carolina to Florida arrested after witnesses say she attacked crew members before being wrestled to the floor. The latest incident comes on the heels of a couple others, a JetBlue captain who had to be subdued by passengers after he apparently ran up and down screaming all kinds of things about the plane and terrorism. That was on a flight from New York's Kennedy Airport to Las Vegas. And then a few weeks ago, an American Airlines flight attendant, she went ballistic, running up and down as well. What is going on with these people? Let's check in. Dr. Leonard Coldwell, not only an expert on cancer, but an expert on stress. Leonard, something's going on here. What do you think?
Absolutely, George. The problem is this fear-mongering from the government from all angles, then the TSA threats and interference with the security issues. All of this is basically based on fear-mongering. If you have a fight-or-flight mechanism triggered by these kinds of constant threats that are out there towards the pilots, the government is talking about terrorists, and the only terrorists I know about the last couple of years were the underwear bomber and the shoe bomber that the government put into the planes. But this constant threat is out there, and fear and stress causes fight-or-flight. With the JetBlue pilot, we really saw it's basically a nervous breakdown. What will happen, and this is just the beginning, George, it's not the end, because when these pilots go through just to the TSA checkpoints, all the pressure that's there now, the radiation threat that's there to the full body scanners, but then all the economic threats that are out there, It all accumulates. It's not just one threat anymore. We have this fear all over. But the artificially created fear for terrorists that the government is using to push new laws through that suppressing our civil rights more and more and enhancing the powers of the Patriot Act and all these kind of elements are the basis for these kind of nervous breakdowns. And there is no outlet because there's only one side of the story. There's only threats. There's only fear-mongering. Mm-hmm. And these pilots have no way, or the flight crews in general, have really no way to go with their thoughts and their fears and their worries. As far as I know, nobody is really taking care of them. And stress, as you know, as we always talk about, George, is the main cause of cancer, but it's also the main cause of every kind of pathological behaviors that we see now in all the flight crews and pilots, and it's just the beginning. It will get worse and worse and worse because it gets the fear mongering gets worse every minute.
And Leonard, I bet it's got to filter down though into other areas, other sectors, not just those people who fly planes. It's got to be everywhere now.
It is absolutely everywhere, George. Because you turn on the TV and you see threats of earthquakes and threats of tornadoes. The economy is going down. The dollar is going to be worthless. So people live in constant fear. And fear is the main control mechanism of governments. As long as we can remember, the governments have used fear to control us. Because if we are scared enough, we cannot think clearly anymore. If we get be based on stress and fear into a fight and flight mode, our cognitive thinking, our brain doesn't work anymore in the way besides survival. It gets in a survival mode, and in the survival mode, we are unable to see the whole picture anymore. We are only there to survive. We're only there to fight or run away. And this is where we all are right now with our stress level. And the stress is the main energy drainer. So what will happen if these people get in fight or flight mode, they cannot think rationally anymore. And this is where all these, this is basically what these pilots or the female flight attendant showed, is nothing else than a nervous breakdown. coming from an accumulation of fears, from accumulation of stresses, where people don't have an outlet. It's the same problem like we have with our soldiers coming back from the war zones from Iraq and Afghanistan.
That's a good point, Leonard. Leonard, I want to give out this special email, by the way, that you've given us for our listeners. If anybody has any kind of questions, medical issues, questions about stress, questions about cancer, Dr. Leonard Coldwell has set up a special email address that you can send him an email. It's Instinct, okay? InstinctBasedMedicine@gmail.com. InstinctBasedMedicine@gmail.com. And his website linked up to our Twitter feed now at coasttocoastam.com. Leonard, thanks so much. And you're right. People are just really stressed out. I've been saying it for a couple of years, but we're seeing it now. I was on a flight where a flight attendant was touched by a person on the shoulder. He was trying to get past her in the aisle. That's all. He just kind of wanted, you know, it was just one of those, get out of the way, please. She turned around and just said, don't touch me. So people are uptight. You know, don't take this sitting down, but spending too much time in a chair is bad for your health. Really, really bad. New research published in the Archives of Internal Medicine shows that people who spend a lot of time sitting may be up to 40% more likely to die from any cause compared to people who just don't sit as long. I'm not going to go through all the people that they studied, but bottom line is, get up and start moving around. On our highlights reel at coasttocoastam.com, take a look at a man who has been given a face transplant after living for 15 years as a recluse. He's recovering very well. Richard Lee Norris beginning to feel his face. He's brushing his teeth. He's shaving. Last week, he was given what physicians say the most extensive face transplant ever carried out, including new teeth, nose, tongue, and jaw. He's also regained the sense of his smell. The difference in pictures, which you can see at coasttocoastam.com, unbelievable. 37 years old, he was cut off from the rest of the world. He wore a mask whenever he went outside. He had horrific injuries from a gun accident. An Australian woman has dislocated her neck by sneezing. The 28-year-old woman dislocated two vertebrae in her neck 2 weeks ago after sneezing while sitting up in bed. Well, here we go again, still in Clintonville, Wisconsin. The booming and shaking continues there. Police receiving 95 calls on Tuesday from people reporting three or four loud booms. As he's been following this story for us, Terry Lee from our affiliate WTAQ in Green Bay, Wisconsin, on with us. Terry, this has got to be getting frustrating now. We thought originally this might have been caused from the little tiny earthquake. Now what?
Well, you know, there's still obviously no answers. You know, as of this point, city officials are now requesting seismic monitors from the USGS. No decision has been made there yet, but geophysicists still say the temporary stations could help, you know, focus in on where these events are occurring and what's going on. But geophysicist John Bellaney with the USGS says it's likely that the city is still getting a series of small earthquakes, which is similar to what happens across the U.S. several times a year.
Are people scared, Terry?
Oh, yeah. There's still definitely a lot of unnerved residents in the area here, you know, and the community is actually trying to bring some support and bring some, you know, some confidence into that the city is trying to do everything they actually are capable of doing, really, at this point, and even offering a nice T-shirt to show some sort of unity, saying, I survived, the 1.5 is now on sale in the city.
All right, Terry, by the way, thank you for the work you've been doing for us. I really appreciate it. Terry Lee from our affiliate WTAQ in Green Bay, Wisconsin. You know, there could be billions of planets not much bigger than Earth circling faint stars in our galaxy, according to an international team of astronomers. And they estimate that the number of super-Earths is based on detections already made and then extrapolated to include the Milky Way's population of so-called red dwarf stars. Billions of planets. It's just exciting. Well, up next, Dimitar Sasolov joins us. We're going to talk about his work, The Life of Super-Earths. It's the hunt for alien worlds and artificial cells that could revolutionize life on our planet. That's all next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Two special hours for you as we talk with Dimitar Sasolov, a well-known astronomer, world-renowned, one of the leaders of NASA's Kepler mission. And Dr. Sasolov coined the term super-Earth in 2000. He's a professor of astronomy at Harvard University, founder and director of the Harvard Origins of Life Initiative. And here he is on Coast to Coast. Doctor, welcome. How are you?
Good morning, or good evening, wherever you are.
We're everywhere.
Yeah, that's true.
What an exciting project here. Were you involved in this latest research study where, you know, they claim that there could be billions of Earth-like planets out there?
No, I'm not on the team that just announced that. I work with them. We are collaborating on a bigger project, and this is the result of several years of their previous work now bearing fruit and showing that this kind of planets seem to be quite common.
You know, years ago, Doctor, we all speculated on just how many planets there could be just out there in the universe. And, of course, before Kepler and before they started studying other planets, you know, people would speculate. But a lot of us thought, you know what, this universe is the same. It's got the same complexity that there could be. If there are billions of stars, there could also be billions of planets out there. And, you know, I guess science is beginning to find that that's absolutely the case. It's got to be exciting for scientists like you.
Indeed. It's great to be living through that period of time when we finally can discover this planet. And indeed, I would say a few of us doubted that the planets are out there. But there is a two things about discovering them now. One of them is just the sheer satisfaction that, yes, we have now evidence that the planets are common and we can find them. But more importantly, George, it's important to discover them because then you can actually study them. You know where they are, and you can train your big telescopes towards some of the more interesting ones and find out what they are and what the conditions on their surfaces are. And it's very exciting because it already has taught us that the sheer variety and richness of new worlds out there is amazing.
It sure is. How are they finding these kinds of planets, Doctor?
Well, we've figured out several different ways to find planets. The first one, which worked pretty well, and for the first time bore fruit about a dozen years ago, is what we call the Doppler shift wobble, or the stellar wobble.
Mm-hmm.
Doppler shift is this effect from physics, which is known since the time of the 19th century physicist Doppler, and it's named after him. And it applies to any wave phenomenon, including sound waves. So we experience it when we have cars passing by in the change of the pitch of the sound. But it also applies to light, and we can use it to observe very carefully distant stars. And in some cases, we notice that they move slowly towards us, then away from us, then again towards us. Turns out that this is due to the gravitational pull of an unseen planet, a planet which is otherwise not visible to our telescopes. This is how the first exoplanets, or planets orbiting other stars, were discovered with this wobbling method, or wobble method. Nowadays, especially with the new space telescope, the Kepler telescope, by NASA, we're using a new technique, which we call the transit method.
Okay, what is that?
Transits are little eclipses that occur when a planet passes in front of its parent star. So those eclipses are not true eclipses, the way the moon covers the entire face of the sun, but really tiny ones, and they're called transits. They dim the light of the star just a little bit by a percent or less than a percent, but certainly enough for us to detect it. And when you see a star dimming regularly, once every year or once every month, you know that maybe there is a planet that is orbiting it. So that's how Kepler discovers its planets, and that has been the most successful method in the past few years.
With this new theory that there might be billions of Earth-like planets out there, Can we assume, Doctor, that most star systems probably have planets with them?
Yes, we are coming close to confirming that assumption. In fact, we'll do better than simply assuming that. The ultimate goal of the NASA Kepler mission is to give science a pretty precise number of that fraction of planets around other stars. And now it seems that the fraction will be very high. But the actual number will come out in a couple of years from now.
And if a planet happens to possess water, a temperature relatively close to what we have here on planet Earth, give or take, what are the odds, in your opinion? What are the odds of some kind of life developing on that planet?
Well, George, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Sure is.
That is the big question. And, you know, it's exciting in science when one of those ancient big questions can be tackled, maybe not completely, but at least partially by the methods of science. You can learn something new. That's what we are trying to do now, because with the discovery of such planets coming from Kepler and other searches here from the ground, we are coming to the point where we have to ask that question, because now we can study those planets and say, okay, what we see there is something which is due to volcanoes, maybe to an atmosphere similar to a planet like Venus or Mars. But what about those other planets where maybe we see signatures of biology there? Mm-hmm. We have to figure out what to do about this. How often does what happened here on Earth occur on other planets? And part of it is, if it's something which happens often, then hopefully we'll know very soon, in the next 20 years or so. If it doesn't happen that often, how do we maximize our chances to discover it? And so that means we have to learn something more about the nature of life here on Earth.
It's going to be exciting times. Can we find out how old these other planetary systems are? You know, here we are 4.5 billion years old. Do we know the age of some of these other planets we're beginning to discover?
As a matter of fact, we do. This is a really interesting story. We can't do it directly the way we do it here on Earth. Here on Earth, the way we know the age of the Earth is by studying rocks. Geologists have discovered on a few locations around the globe very old ancient rocks, which we can measure with the methods of physics and determine their precise ages, going back 4 billion years and even older, 4.5. Now, when you have a planet which is that far away, you only see the light coming from it, there is no chance you will do anything of that sort. But it turns out we have a way to figure it out, and it has to do with the age of the star. So as it happens, we don't know of any other way to form planets but together with the formation of their parent star. And that means that the age of the star is equal to the age of its planet. And we have figured out in the last 20 years how to measure the ages of stars with something which we call stellar seismology, very similar to astroseismology when there are earthquakes, to seismology here on Earth when there are earthquakes. We see the waves passing through the Earth and we can measure them on the surface. Well, it turns out we can measure such waves on the surfaces of stars. We've been doing that now for 30 years on the surface of our own star, the Sun. And it gives you a measure of how long that star has been in existence. And we know that the Sun is exactly as old as the oldest rocks that we find in the solar system, so everything matches pretty well. And that's how, especially with Kepler, we've been able to measure the ages of a few of those stars that we also know have planets. We discovered their planets. So by that
right, stay with us, Doctor. Dr. Dimitar Sasalov, his book, The Life of Super Earths, back with much more on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie with our special guest for the next couple hours, Dimitar Sasalov, as we talk about the life of super Earths. And tell me how you got involved in writing this incredible story, Dimitar.
Well, thank you for the nice words. It started about 5 years ago. A colleague of mine, Andy Knoll, and I designed a class for non-science majors here at Harvard, freshmen, students who were just interested in science, but otherwise working on something else. And we were very excited about these new developments, both in astronomy with the discovery of exoplanets and in biology. He is a biologist himself. And we thought that we should teach that to the students. And that's how the book started. And it was interactions with the students that taught me how to try to explain those new and exciting scientific concepts to people who are not necessarily scientists. So it took an effort, but I'm happy that it produced a book that is readable.
Well, you know, let's go back for just a second. Explain to us scientifically why the star and the planet are relatively the same age. I always thought the star came first, so explain that.
That's a good question. The star always comes first because the way we see stars forming out there in the galaxy around us, even in nearby galaxies, is always from the large amounts of gas that is there in the spiral arms and parts of the galaxy. And that gas at some point cools down and compresses out under its own weight. It essentially falls onto itself to form a bunch of very dense cores, we call them, very dense parts of that cloud, which then continue compressing until they become so hot from this compression that they start burning, which we then call a star, a newly formed star. So the star always forms first. But what happens is in that collapse, as we call it, of the large cloud onto a very small and tiny, dense piece, which eventually becomes a star, there's always a little bit of spin, of rotation. And that spins inevitably forms a disk around the newly formed star. Okay. We see them nowadays with the Hubble Space Telescope, with other telescopes. We see those disks around newly formed young stars. And this is in those disks that planets form from the compressed solids, usually dust particles, ice particles. In these disks is how planets form. And that's why planets usually form in systems like our solar system, where all the orbits are in the same plane and move in the same direction. So that's essentially is the story of how planets form. So indeed, the star is there a little bit earlier, but the difference between the age of the star and the first planets forming is just a million years or a few million years. So over what, billions of years, who cares about a million years, you know?
What coagulates the planet, the dust, and as it spins and it forms this shape of a ball, what coagulates it? What makes it stick together and what makes it harden the way it is?
You know, George, this was a big mystery until very recently. We had the sense that as the disk spins around the newly formed star, it basically becomes quite thin. All the solids in the disk accumulate in the plane. And that makes that plane very dense in those solids, in the dust and ices. So they simply stick to each other. But it was not quite clear how they would stick to become big bodies like asteroids, then bodies the size of the moon, and then they will grow to become even bigger. So people had to do experiments in the lab. They literally shot little pieces of dirt against each other to see how well it sticks. Some of those were done in the space station out in space because it's good if there is no wait in waitlessness. So now, after 10 years of very solid work in the lab, we think we understand all the different stages of how these little microscopic dust particles stick to each other, become big, bigger, and then grow to become what we call planetesimals. And then from a large number of planetesimals, eventually you end up with a dozen planets.
I feel like I'm back in
some of them much bigger.
I feel like I'm back in college learning again, and you're doing a great job explaining this to us.
It's funny that most of that was figured out only recently, and we still don't know. The honest answer is we still don't understand the whole process of planet formation, and the hope is that with these new discoveries of planetary systems with Kepler, we'll actually finally have a good solid theory of planet formation.
The universe is about 14 billion years old. How old were some of the earliest stars? I mean, how soon did a star start develop after the universe apparently was developed?
Now, this is a very important point that you're making, George. The first stars that we haven't yet observed directly probably formed about 500 million years after the original
Big Bang.
Release of light from the initial gas that we see from the very, very early universe. So the first stars, it takes them about 300 to 500 million years to form. But these are very unusual stars because the universe at that time, as we see it, is made of hot gas, which is mostly hydrogen and helium, nothing else. And then it takes another couple of generations of stars from those first stars until you start forming all the other elements of the table of the chemical elements, carbon, silicon, and iron, and so on. So by the time you have stars which have enough metals, as we call them, dust particles, ice, to form the solid planets, the ones like the Earth and the super-Earths, a couple of billion years have passed, and maybe even 4 billion years. So it's about 9 to 10, maybe even 8 billion years ago when most of these first planets could form around those early young stars at the time.
I would assume if the universe indeed, again, is 14 billion years old and we're 4.5 billion years old, then we're on the younger stage of the universe in terms of our planetary existence. Is that a pretty good guess?
Absolutely. And this is one of the main points which I wanted to make in my new book. I wanted to convey the message to everybody out there is that we are inhabiting the early, the pioneering years of the existence of a universe that will go on for many, many hundreds of billions of years into the future as we see it today. It won't change very much in that future, but that tells us that we are in those first early pioneering days of a very interesting world, and we are one of those first sentient beings that can see it as it was when it was young.
When the universe started, why isn't everything the same age? Why are new planets being developed now? New star systems are being developed. What's the reason for that? You would think if it starts, it all starts. But does time and space have anything to do with it?
Yes, indeed. In fact, that's a very good point. It's only 50 years ago that people debated the point. They couldn't see the telescopes that they had. My colleagues at the time were not large enough to see very far. They only could see the nearest galaxies, the size of our own galaxy, and that was pretty far anyway. But they couldn't see those early times of the universe at the time. So there were all kinds of different ideas that maybe the universe is eternal and very old. A few people actually thought that the universe was as young as we know it is today, and particularly the stars and the galaxies, only about 13 billion years old. So what we see now is this whole sequence of events. And it's quite fascinating. So let me kind of enumerate them for you, starting from the earliest, most distant parts that we see.
Okay.
What we see most, the earliest and furthest from us, is a time when the universe was just very hot gas. As I said, hydrogen and helium, literally. We actually see this. This has been measured now pretty well. And then it takes about 100 or more, 200 million years, and that gas starts cooling down and compressing onto the first blobs, the first galaxies, and in them the first stars. And then you start generation after generation, increasing the number of stars that form. The first stars are very large. The next generations have both large and smaller stars. And we reach a time today when you have well-defined galaxies with a very large variety of stars. Stars like the Sun, which is kind of in between, stars that are slightly bigger, and plentiful of stars that are even smaller than our own Sun. And they have different planets around them. And that sequence from just hydrogen and helium, the universe today, which is rich in iron, in other metals, in carbon, oxygen, is a very clear trend, which increases with time. But most of that enrichment, as we call it, most of that really newly forming objects and phenomena happened in the first few billion years. And now the universe is essentially coasting along. The space-time is expanding, as we learned with Edwin Hubble and the expansion mm-hmm. of the universe. In fact, now we've learned it's slightly accelerating due to yet-to-be-understood dark energy field in the universe, and that got the Nobel Prize this past year. But the point is, the universe started as a hot gas, which is expanding, its space is expanding, it's cooling down, and that allows you to form not only the generations of many stars and the chemical elements, but most importantly for us here on Earth, the planets, especially the rocky planets, which can sustain life as we know it.
Are you a believer now also, Dimitar, in the multiverse theory, that there are many universes perhaps?
Now, this is an interesting question. I don't know whether I would call myself a believer in the multiverse. I would say it's a very interesting hypothesis. And the reason I may sound a little bit skeptical when it mm-hmm. comes to that is not that I don't think that's possible or that we have any evidence against it. It's more that a lot of the reason why we scientists talk about the multiverse as the real landscape of the bigger world out there has to do with this relatively new understanding of the expansion of the universe we live in and the acceleration that I just mentioned a minute ago, which got the Nobel Prize last year. That acceleration that is observed only on very large scales of the universe must be due to a new field, which we currently call dark energy, for lack of better word and understanding. And this is through a number of logical steps what would lead us to believe that maybe there are other equivalent, similar space-times, meaning universes out there, that were not directly accessible to us. This leads you to then the hypothesis that we're just one of a multiple of those in the multiverse. Now, I have to say that there are too many assumptions and logical steps that you have to take along the route to come to that, and obviously we don't have direct evidence. So I will just wait a little bit before I become a true believer in it.
How about wormholes? What are your thoughts on wormholes? And
this is a very beautiful theoretical idea. Unfortunately, we don't quite understand the intricacies of the fabric of space-time to find one easily and have direct evidence. At some level, probably they're possible, It's not clear whether they're large enough to be really useful to ordinary matter, and we are made of ordinary matter. So Contact, as beautiful as a book and movie it is, which uses wormholes to move from one place in the galaxy to another, may never be the way we do it, or our future generations of our species does it. Something of that sort certainly could exist. Physics doesn't exclude it completely. That's why it was developed theoretically as a very interesting idea of connecting two very distant parts of space, say in the galaxy, through kind of a shortcut through the additional dimensions of space-time.
You know, and of course, the big question that we can't answer, how it all started, beyond the Big Bang. I mean, as you say, hydrogen and helium and everything was here. How did it start? How did it get here in the first place?
That's the big question.
And that
is. One of those big questions like the, you know, what is life and how do you go from chemistry to life? Now, this big question could be answered with the multiverse hypothesis. But again, as I said, we are not yet ready to have that as the clear answer. And the evidence for what happened before the period that we observed directly of that hot gas is very faint and distant. So we need to have bigger telescopes. We need to study more in order to get further back into what happened. And ultimately, at some point, there is the question of existence, which is very difficult to answer by the tools of science at this point.
It is fascinating. And we do believe still the universe is expanding out, right?
Yes. It's not only a belief. It's actually a direct observational fact. We see it very clearly. That's what made the detection of the slight acceleration possible, because we could see clearly the expansion. Then on top of that, there was the measurement of the acceleration. So it is the property of the universe, of the world we live in, that on very large scales, and that's very important, on very large scales, space is expanding. This is very important to mention here, because if we say, well, everything is expanding, then so I'm expanding and my house is expanding, the Earth and the orbits in the solar system expanding. That's not true. The expansion only happens on very, very large scales, beyond the size of the galaxy, and the galaxy already is huge. So there is no measurable effect of that expansion here in the solar system, certainly, and for that matter, in the galaxy itself.
Well, it's fascinating. The name of the book we're talking with, of course, Dr. Dimitar Sasalov, The Life of Super Earths. Fascinating story. His website, of course, is the name of the book, lifeofsuperearths.com. When we come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM, we are going to take your phone calls. This is a night of real science and high technology. If you need to email me, george@coasttocoastam.com, we'll make it very simple for you too. And also invite all of you to follow us on Twitter and Facebook. If you're not doing that already, simply go to our website at coasttocoastam.com and click those links that you'll find up there in the upper right-hand corner. I'm George Norrie, and Coast to Coast AM continues in a moment.